forces his back from recess. First bill we will. We were waiting on, the department's been very patient on some of their technical bills, so why don't we go ahead and do Senator Scogin's bill. Senator Rickman.
Which one are you
going to take? Senate File 1184.
1184?
And the reason they're kind of together there is I think Senate File 1250 is covered within the previous bill. So they're kind of going side by side.
I just want to be able to track and follow up.
Yeah. Senate File 1184.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. And I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill for the agency, the DNR's, we'll call it the catch-all or miscellaneous game and fish bill.
Members, this is going to be the game and fish policy bill.
Ed Bogus is here, as you can see tonight. Ed has helped me put this bill together and has walked me through some of the talking points, Mr. Chair, so I'm going to turn it over to him we have an amendment to it, don't we? I'm sorry. You're right, Mr. Knopf. I would offer the A1 amendment to Senate File Number 1184. Cleans up some language. Helps us identify wild turkeys. We'll be able to sleep better tonight if we get this one taken care of.
Senator Scogin moves the A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
Thank you. Ed Bogus, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for DNR. And I think all of you received a fact sheet that describes the items that are in the bill. The numbering of the items that are on the fact sheet don't follow exactly with the sections in the bill, so I'll point out some of the items that are in the fact sheet are contained in several sections of the bill. So I'll quickly walk through the provisions that the bill includes and the author's amendment that the committee just adopted also changes the numbering slightly. But the first portion of the bill deals with definition of immediately released or immediately returned to the water. This is not changing any existing regulations, but we already have a number of references to this in the fishing rules, but we've never defined the term. And so this would make it clear. People ask, can we take a picture? Can we weigh the fish? Things like that. So this just makes it clear that when we say in rule that you have to immediately release or immediately return the fish or else count it as part of your limit, this clarifies what's meant by those terms. The amendment that you just adopted defines a ringneck pheasant and wild turkey as game birds. It's a little different than in the bill as was originally drafted, and we worked with Mr. Knopf on trying to clean up that language. So that's in a new section two of the bill. Section four of the bill is introduced, provides authority for fees for special events on wildlife management areas or aquatic management areas. These are things like dog trawling permits or minnow harvesting permits. And in fact, in the past, we used to charge a nominal fee for those activities, but we discovered that our authorities were not clear to do that, so we're seeking to get core authority for that here. Clarifying and expanding authorities for issuing permits for locally nesting Canada geese and clarifying authorities for other species is found in Section 5 of the bill. The primary impetus for this was a change in federal rule that was adopted last summer. These are migratory birds under federal authority, and the provisions in this bill would allow us to streamline our permitting process or even adopt rules that would allow people to control nests and eggs of Canada geese without a permit. Canada goose numbers, as was alluded to this afternoon, have been increasing. Resident Canada geese numbers have been increasing, and this would allow for easier control of Canada geese by landowners. Section 7 of the bill modifies provisions for upgrading deer licenses. This is really some technical corrections to how people who've already purchased deer licenses and changed their mind can switch to a different type of license. Section 8 deals with the charge when you're taking a protected wild animal without a license. That's already a violation, but we want to create a separate violation for taking while you're under revocation from a license. It would have the same penalty. It would just be a slightly different charge under the law. Section 9, and then you'll see pieces of this in sections 15 and 16, is a new proposal to provide for an apprentice hunter program. This has been tried in a few other states, Michigan and Ohio among them, and this would allow a person to once in their lifetime be able to go hunting with someone else who's licensed and closely accompanying them without having to possess a firearm safety certificate. Right now, anyone born from January 1st, 1980 has to have a firearm safety certificate. This is part of our proposed recruitment and retention. Allow a person a one-time exemption from that as long as they're closely accompanied, so they can either try it out, or if they were unable to get into a course, they can hunt that year, but they have to go back and take the course before the following year.
So, Mr. Bogus, is that going to be tracked through ELS?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it would be. The system would be programmed to allow you to do this once. Right now, it's programmed to make sure that if you're born after that date, that you do have a firearm safety certificate. This would track that you could get this validation one time. Once you'd gotten that, it would no longer let you get a small game license or a hunting license without that firearm safety certificate.
Have you considered, this kind of gets into the realm of, dare I mention the term, hunting age? Have you thought about having this apprentice program with validation for, say, 11-year-olds? If they can pass a test, or if they can, I suppose you're exempting them from the test under this.
Mr. Chair, this gives them the one-year exemption from the test. Right now, they can take the class at 11. They can't get the actual certificate until age 12. For small game, there is no minimum age, but for deer, there is a minimum age, and that age is 12 because you have to have a firearm safety certificate to hunt deer.
What if they pass the test while they're 11? Have you thought about letting them do this apprentice validation?
Mr. Chair, they would be able to because their certificate isn't valid. They can actually take the test at age 11, but their certificate does not become valid until age 12. So this apprentice would allow them. Well, except we hadn't anticipated, at least I hadn't been involved in any discussions on allowing them to, say, hunt deer at age 11 with this provision. So this would not allow for this the way it's drafted right now.
Right. I'm not reading that it would. That's why I was asking if you'd.
Yeah, that's not. It's not something that we'd really thought about, but we could give that some more thought.
Okay. Back on the wild animal taking, it's guilty of a misdemeanor. What's the charge now?
Mr. Chair, and we have Mr. Conrad here from our enforcement division, but it is right now, the charge is hunting without a license, and it's a misdemeanor. This would also add a charge, a slightly separate charge of hunting while your privilege to purchase a license has been revoked. My understanding is just something the county attorneys would like to more correctly charge the person. It doesn't change the penalty.
Okay. Thank you.
Section 10 of the bill would make it clear that spouses of residents who are on active military duty can obtain resident licenses. Right now, active military who are back in the state on leave can hunt without a license. They just, if it's a big game species, they need to get a tag. This would make it clear that their spouse could get a resident license even if they did not have a Minnesota driver's license. Right now, we've been requiring that they have a Minnesota driver's license, but if they're living on a base somewhere else, as long as they're a spouse of a resident, this would allow them to get a resident the spouse to get a resident license, and the member of the military would still be able to hunt without a license.
Can they fish without a license?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Active duty can fish without a license? Under current law?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's true.
Because I joined up.
Active duty on leave, just need to show leave papers to hunt and fish. If it's a species that requires tags, then they have to get the they have to take their leave papers to an ELS agent, and they'll be issued a license with tags.
Well, the reason why I'm confused is because my brother is active duty. Last year, came back to Minnesota to ice fish, and you know, he had to buy a license. And we asked if he gets a free license, and the person said no.
Mr. Chair, I think there's some confusion. When my son was home during deer hunting from the Air Force, we asked too, and they said he had to get a license. And then we later found out that we had just asked the wrong person. I just don't think it's clear out in the field what that rule is.
Mr. Chair, I think we're researching that question right now, and I have the statutes also. I know for sure on hunting. I'm not as sure on fishing. It's Mr. Knopf looks like it. Yes.
Mr. Chair, the residence on leave is basically any resident who's on leave, but it has to be, they have to maintain their residency in Minnesota. And if they're on leave, they may hunt or fish without a license if they possess the official military leave papers. The issue is they wouldn't go in and get a fishing license. They would just have to have the papers on their possession at the time, the leave papers. And I assume if you go into a holiday station, they wouldn't necessarily know that.
They have to be a resident of Minnesota.
Yes. Yes, it's a resident who's in active service, who's in the state on leave.
Sounds like we need to do better. Maybe a question on the ELS.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf is correct. They really don't have to go to an ELS agent if they're a resident on leave, because all they have to do is show an officer their papers, and that's all they need. The only reason they need to go to an ELS agent is if they need to get a tag, like for deer hunting. Section 11 is a purely technical correction. The all-season license was changed last year to allow for three tags, but we missed changing two to three in this section of the statutes. Section 12 allows non-residents under age 18 to obtain hunting and fishing licenses at the resident fee, and this was also in Senator Scogin's other bill for under age 16. So this encompasses what he was proposing in his other bill, plus it extends it up through age 17, and it also does the same thing in the amendment that was adopted earlier for small game hunting. This does have some fiscal implications, but we feel it's a way to encourage more participation by youth, and we are confident that those youth are going to bring more adults with them when they participate in big game and small game hunting. The other thing that this section does is eliminates the reciprocal fee for the non-resident archery deer license, and there's also, I think you've heard, a separate bill that does that same thing.
Section Senator Parasol?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You are still on Section 12, Mr.
Yes, yes.
I have a question about on line 528. Oh, no, excuse me, 529. It seems to me that kind of is inconsistent for persons age 16, 17 to take small game $6 with the fact that you have people in the next line, age 12 to 18, take deer with firearms. I'm trying to figure why 16 and 17 were singled out, because that's pretty tight compared to what we had in law before, right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Parasol, they don't need a license for small game until they hit age 16. So I'm not sure if I understand your question. It is current law allows persons under, and if you go back to the, we've actually done this a little differently in the amendment that was adopted at the start, but current law allows a non-resident under age 16 to obtain a small game license at the resident fee. So if they're a non-resident, we require a license no matter what age they are. The residents don't need a license until age 16. What we're proposing to do here is change under age 16 to under age 18.
So you're just easing them up to 18.
Right.
I want to be sure that we're very clear on that issue. You come here, you don't have to go if you're in a service. But if we don't make it clear, I'm going to pull this to my Veterans Committee, and I don't want to have to do that. I want to be sure we're on the same playing field. So I can't have one game warden saying we need one, somebody else saying you don't need one. I just want to be clear. And I think that we owe that to our people in the service.
It's going to be a lot of returning vets.
3,600.
A lot of returning active vets. So do we have an idea of how we're going to educate our
Mr. Chair and Senator Vickerman, I think a lot of it. Yeah, I think a lot of it is the license agents knowing that, you know, when they come in to get a license, to tell them that they don't need a license, except for deer, things like that. So it is a good point, and I think we do put it in the regulations booklet, and I'm sure we also, when we train our agents, that we are talking about that. But it's with the increase in returning service people, it is something that I agree we should emphasize more.
I'm wondering if in that we do that little question and answer thing on the ELS station. That might be something to consider, is that just to simply ask, are you a active duty military member, resident of the state? That way the ELS station doesn't even think about it. Say, yes, I am. You know, the alarm goes off. No license needed. Something along those lines.
We'll look into that,
problems.
Mr. Chair.
Something like that?
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, they got enough to worry about. Legal or not. I just want to be clear.
Can I just make one clarifying statement? This would not apply to somebody who's leaving the armed forces or a returning veteran. I think you stated that. I just want to make sure it's very clear that they're on active duty and they're home on leave and they have leave papers.
We are considering some changes for the veterans as well. Okay.
Okay, moving on to section 13, that eliminates an obsolete prohibition on using commercial cold storage facilities for protected wild animals other than fish and furs. Current law says you can only use commercial cold storage for fish and furs, but we know people are using them for deer and other species, so just cleaning up an old kind of outdated statute. Similarly, on section 14, there's a prohibition on shipping the meat of fur bears, rabbits, squirrels, etc., out of state, and that we think dates back to some of the market hunting era and is no longer a statute that we really need or that we really enforce. People that rabbit hunt in other states can take the rabbits back with them or ship them home. Sections 15 and 16 are additional portions of the apprentice provision that I discussed earlier, to allow a person the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go hunting with someone without having to have completed firearm safety. Section 17 is a very technical change. We have been prescribing some shooting hours prior to the Sunday of the second weekend of the waterfowl season. We've been extending the 4 o'clock closure, for example, through that Saturday, and the spinning wing decoy law, or the motorized decoy law, goes through that Saturday. But we discovered this last year that we really only have authority to prescribe hours before that Saturday, so we only prescribe them through Friday, where we had been doing it through Saturday for many years. And so this would allow us to extend those shooting hours on or before the Saturday nearest October 8th and get through that Saturday of the second weekend for the 4 o'clock closure. And the 4 o'clock closure has been very important because Minnesota has more duck hunters than any other state. And most of the harvest occurs on the first weekend of the season. And by closing at 4 o'clock during that first week, we save a lot of our resident ducks while migrants are kind of filling into the state later into the season. Section 18 would clarify how antlerless deer can be taken with the all-season license. I mentioned earlier we added a tag to the license last year in the legislature, and we thought we had the language workable for how you could take antlerless deer under that license. When we went to put the hunting regulations together last summer, we discovered that language really didn't work. It wouldn't allow, for example, three antlerless deer to be taken by firearms during the firearm season with that license, and we certainly want to encourage taking of antlerless deer. So this would just give the commissioner authority to prescribe how antlerless deer could be taken, and then leave the other provisions in statute. Sections 19 and 20 also, I may have skipped over a section earlier. They also relate back to something that was in section 6 that relates to the pictorial stamp for pheasant and waterfowl as a license requirement. Right now, we have four types of stamps that we issue, trout and salmon stamp and turkey stamp. All you need is the validation on the license, but for the pheasant and the duck stamp, after 30 days, you actually have to physically have that stamp and have it signed, or else you're in violation. This would make all the stamps the same and would provide that just the validation on the license is all you need for hunting. We would still continue to do the contests to produce the stamps, to send the stamps out to collectors for an additional fee of $2.
So we have to sign your license?
Mr. Chair, you would still have to sign your license, but on the license it would list what you were authorized to do. Small game hunting, pheasant, duck would all just be listed on the license. Right now, those could be
you
listed
do
on
sign your license.
You do right
your
now.
Stamp.
Right, and the problem that we've had is a lot of people buy those stamps, Mr. Chairman, in the springtime when they buy their sports license. We mail them the stamp in April. In October when they need it, they can't find it.
Yeah,
it says right on their license they bought it, but they don't have it,
yeah.
So they're in violation.
Guilty.
You can always buy another one.
And I have.
So have I, Mr. Chairman. Section 21 just expands the options for being able to identify the trap tags, and it would allow the use of the Minnesota DNR number. This is a number that we issue people that buy licenses. It stays the same once we issue it. Current law allows either name and address or a driver's license number, but because all the driver's license numbers are changing over, this would give the option of using a license that doesn't change. It would also extend the time that we would recognize old driver's license numbers as we're changing over from existing driver's license numbers. So it's just providing an additional option for identifying trap tags.
Back on the stamp, so not even the waterfowl stamp is going to be necessary, right?
Mr. Chair, under this, none of the stamps would be required or signing the stamps or
the anything. Federal would be.
Mr. Chair, that's a good point. You would still need the federal stamp. There is a pilot proposal that's being pursued to go to an electronic federal stamp, and we may be a pilot state for that, but right now the federal stamp is still a requirement.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pearson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rogers, I still have a question about the identification number for Section 21 starting on page 832, line 832. Why can't they be given a permanent number? I understand 2013 is not very close, but just the same.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pariseau, as far as the DNR is concerned, that number is a permanent number. Once we give you a DNR number, once you buy a license in the ELS system, you'll see on your license Minnesota DNR number, and that number never changes. It's the same on every license and every year.
So if it was your permanent driver's license number, it would still be your lifetime number?
It's a different number, Mr. Chair and Senator Parasol. It's a different number than your driver's license number. It's a number that DNR assigns, but it's unique to an individual.
Another question related to that, the Advanced Hunter Education Certificate. Your certificate number is your driver's license number, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that has been the case. I'm not sure on the new driver's license numbers if that's still the case.
That was the question. Does your certificate number then change with your driver's license?
Mr. Chair, I'm hearing from Mr. Conrad that once you've been issued it, it stays the same. The new ones may have the new driver's license number, but the old ones are not changing.
So you have a new driver's license number, and you're hunting out of state expecting that your driver's license number is your advanced hunter certificate number, but you got to remember your old driver's license number?
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct, or else you have to find your old certificate. That's my understanding, is it's not being updated to correspond. Once they're issued, then they go into the database with that number.
You got to figure that out sometime.
Mr. Chairman.
I think it's anyone's fault, but it's an unintended consequence that's kind of going to get confusing.
Mr. Chairman, I was wondering when I heard about this at least a year ago, that I was trying to figure out what brain in the whole state decided to change driver's license numbers every time you get a renewal. That doesn't make any sense to me. I don't imagine why anybody else would want to think that was reasonable either. Why even change numbers all the time on a driver's license?
Then we also have, you know, I thought we passed something a couple years ago that had the Advanced Hunter Education Certificate endorsement to be on the driver's license. I don't know, maybe we could work out something with that. Helps where you have your endorsement on your driver's license, but maybe you could add the number next to the endorsement. Maybe that's a way around this issue. Something to think about.
Yeah, you raise a good point, Mr. Chair.
We should maybe think about try to solve it this year. There's something simple. Let's try and do it.
Mr. Chair, we'll make a note of that, and our enforcement division administers that database of all those numbers, and we'll see if there's some way to try to make a crosswalk between them or something.
Yeah.
Section 22 authorizes fees for fishing contest permits. Current law requires that for contests that not all fishing contests need permits, but for those that do, current law requires that those be issued without a fee. Our Citizens Budget Oversight Committee has recommended that we charge a fee to recover the costs of issuing and monitoring those contests. Currently, just for our fisheries costs, those are about $108,000 a year. We have about 600 permit applications annually. And this would give us authority to set those fees and collect those fees. And there's a corresponding provision in the budget bill that would appropriate those fees back. So, and this is something we're working with the contest organizers. We don't have the exact methodology worked out yet on how those fees would be structured, but probably be some combination of number of participants, purse, and those types of things. Section 23 provides authority to regulate fishing for wildlife or other habitat values. Right now, the only authority that we have to regulate fishing is to protect fish, and the best example of how we'd like to use this authority is Lake Christina, it's a large, shallow lake in western Minnesota that we've twice treated with rote known to remove the fish. We've wanted to restrict fishing on that lake. In fact, we have restricted fishing on that lake to avoid accidental or intentional reintroduction of fish. But then we as we looked closely at our authority, saw that we really don't have the authority to restrict the taking of fish except to protect fish themselves. So this would broaden the authority. Also, the other example where we're thinking we may want to use this type of authority is that chumming for fish, especially for bow fishing, is becoming more common, and this would give us some authority to regulate use of chumming or other types of restrictions like that if it's necessary to protect habitat or water quality. Section 24 establishes a civil penalty for failing to remove a fish house or other structure that's left on the ice after the deadlines. And it basically just cross-references back to the litter laws where there are provisions for civil penalties. And then there are two repealers, Mr. Chairman and members, in this bill. One repeals a fish buyer's license. We've not sold any of those licenses. These are the licenses to buy fish from commercial licensees, and we haven't sold any of those since 2003, and we only sold one in the 2 years prior to that, so there's just no longer a need for that license. The other is repealing 97C365, which says you may not have a spear within a dark house or fish house while angling, and last year the law was changed to allow angling in a dark house or fish house as long as the fish was immediately released or placed on the ice. So we just missed this repealing this provision at the time that law was passed. So that concludes the content of the bill.
A question on Section 24, Mr. Boggess. You mentioned that after the deadlines, does this now... I'm thinking about the person who carries everything he uses out to go on ice fish and carries it out when he goes home at the evening. Does that change the licensure of that shelter or a temporary shelter, whatever knockdown you can use?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pariseau, I'll ask enforcement if they have anything to add after I respond, but my understanding is this, there's still provisions for you to take shelters on and off the ice after the deadlines as long as you don't leave them unattended during certain hours of the day. This would only apply to those that are left out there in violation of the law on removing them.
So that wouldn't be a daily requirement, it would be end of season?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pariseau, yeah, at the end of the season they're required to be removed, but there's still a provision after that that lets you take them on and off daily, and it's just if they're not removed after that deadline or they're left out there longer than is allowed on a daily basis, then this would kick in.
Senator Sharon.
Just for my information, perhaps you spoke to this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a permit required to have a structure on the ice? Is there a permitting process that somebody has to have in order to have an ice fishing house?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, yes, there is a shelter license that's required, and then there's also identification that's required on all those shelters, at least the ones that are used for angling.
Further discussion on Senate File 1184.
Mr. Boggess, I think I found the section you're looking for that you just earlier. I just didn't know if you wanted to make sure that you remember what it was. It's section 6, starting on page 2. That was the part where you're also saying that the stamp will not have to be mailed out to the person and that they have to pay a $2 fee in addition to get the tutorial stamp. I don't know if you wanted to.
Mr. Chair and members, yeah, yes, that's correct. I kind of hit on this later in the bill because there's two other sections that deal with the same provision, but I did inadvertently skip over section 6, and that's relates back again to the discussion that we had on the pictorial stamp as a license requirement, and provides it. People would still be able to get that stamp. They would just have to pay an additional handling fee of $2 to do so. And Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin mentioned, and I think mentioned on one one point. There are a couple of provisions in the bill that have some fiscal implications. Those are mentioned at the end of the fact sheet. The permits for special events on WMAs have a very minimal fiscal impact. The non-resident youth provisions do have, and we're working on a fiscal note, do have some more significant impact on revenues, reduced revenues. And similarly, the eliminating the reciprocal fee for the archery license has about a little over $70,000 fiscal impact. However, that's the only license that has this the only non-resident license where we do this reciprocity. All other non-resident licenses are just a flat fee in statute. So just so the committee is aware of that, I know your committee is not necessarily focused on the fiscal aspect.
What kind of impact are you looking at from the stamp no longer being required?
Mr. Chair, that will save some money because right now we're mailing all of those stamps and I may have at least a rough I'm not finding my notes on that, Mr. Chair, but I believe it's in the range of a $40,000 a year savings. We will have a fiscal note.
I didn't mean to make a dig.
It's, Mr. Chair, right now we're estimating about $49,000 for pheasant and about a $37,000 for waterfowl.
Senator Bill?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vaugus, a couple years ago we voted to legalize the hunting of doves in this state, mourning doves. How's that going?
Mr. Chair, Bye. Senator Dill, it's going pretty smoothly.
Do you have any idea how many doves are taken per year by hunters?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, we do small game harvest estimates every year, and the federal government also does similar estimates for migratory birds. And I'm thinking that we had about 15,000 dove hunters, and they took somewhere around 100,000 doves. That's in the ballpark.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if my wife had her way, I'd vote to repeal that law.
Mr. Boggess, what is the estimated dove population of the state?
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, it's in the range of 10 million. It's a very small percentage.
Mr. Knopf, suggestion on the process with the finance portion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you've got a couple of issues here. You've got provisions in here that relate to finance, and you've got provisions that don't relate, that don't have any financial implications. But you also have provisions in here that are exempting them from rulemaking. Many times exemptions for rulemaking need to be seen in the state and local government before they pass. So the issue then is what to do with this bill, whether or not you want to pass the whole bill on to state and local government and on to finance, or whether you want to retain some of the provisions that are policy only for an omnibus policy bill and then send on the sections. You may have to do that either as a part of this bill or a part of another bill to do that. But it's just an issue of the rule.
Senate File 1250 mirror provisions in 1184?
Mr. Chairman, it contains one provision that deals with the non-resident youth license for small game, if I remember right.
But they are identical?
Well, they're identical actually, what they're trying to do.
Mr. Chair, 1184 actually goes a little further. Which I wouldn't. I plan to set my other bill aside.
Mr. Chair, I think, I don't remember the number of the other bill, but it was for deer only. This is for deer and small game, non-resident youth, and it also was under 16, and this bill is for under 18.
Okay.
but they're very similar in their intent, I think.
So one suggestion would be Senator Anderson, before you arrived, we had talked about this 1184 being the omnibus game and fish bill. It's got to go to rules, and it's got to go to finance, because it's got money in it. One suggestion has been that we amend, delete the finance portion out of this bill and amend it on to Senate File 1250 and send that to your committee, so that those finance portions would be covered, but they'd only need to make one stop.
And then, Mr. Chair, and then take all the language out of 1250 and replace, and you'll just take that and the version
replace
from 1184
it with language from
on
1184.
As policy?
I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah.
That's fine, Mr. Okay. Chair, as long as I get the finance changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think this is going to have to be a kind of a description to council on what we're doing, and then you'll have to write it up, write out exactly what we do for the Girl Scout. If members are comfortable with that, why don't you go ahead and describe, Mr. Knopf, what we're going to do?
Mr. Chairman, what you would do, what you would be doing is adopting, first of all, deleting from this bill sections 4, 6, 10, 12, 20, and 22. And then those sections, and then after you delete them from this section, you can bring up Senate File 1250 and then adopt those sections or delete everything and then to Senate File 1250. There may be a section, if I missed one, I apologize. Those are the sections that I've quickly noted here. If somebody else has any other sections, let me know. But those would be then deleted from this bill and then adopted to delete everything to Senate File 1250. This bill, or Senate File 1250, would then be sent on to state and local government first and then on to the finance committee. And then this bill would be, the remainder of it would be all policy.
Okay, so you're saying 1250 would be the one that makes two stops.
It's your choice. I was thinking that might be easier.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, is the part about the, sorry I was late, about the exemptions from rules that's tied into the fiscal pieces? I mean, it'd be better if it doesn't have to go to another committee before it goes to finance.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, they are.
Okay.
They're exempting them from rulemaking for fees.
Oh. Okay. That's pretty tight.
Mr. Chair?
What about
19? Mr. Knopf, would you look at 19 real quick and see if that should be included in your delete?
Thank you.
What about section 23?
No. Chairman, no. They already have rulemaking authority for that.
Mr. Chair, can I just to make sure, I apologize because I don't want to waste time that you've already talked about, but the exemption from the fees, is that, that's for some fees that are not actually established in here? Or the fees that are, the new fees that are established in here don't need to be exempted from rulemaking? Is it just subsection 4 that you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, it's section 4 and section 22. And those are fees that would be established by the commissioner. The fees that are being changed in here don't need to go to state or government, but those two would have, my understanding, because they're exempting them from rulemaking.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Mueller can help us, but I don't know if those two sections actually have a fiscal impact at per se. I mean, they will ultimately, but I don't know if they will have a, one of them is, well, maybe they will.
Senator Anderson, section 22, Mr. Bogus was explaining that it's going to go into an account.
Yeah, okay.
Going to go into an account.
Forget about it. We'll have to do it that way.
All right, so Senator Stogan will remove the amendment described by Senator Stogan, Mr. Knopf, Senator Knopf. Is there any discussion on that? You all understand what we're doing? Okay, seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, motion prevails, amendment's adopted. So then we have Senate File 1184, which no longer has rulemaking or fees in. Is there any other other discussion on 1184?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pearson.
Will this become the omnibus bill?
The omnibus environment policy
correct,
bill?
Correct.
No. This we're going to lay this bill over for inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. The omnibus policy bill will be 1312.
Do you need me to clean up 1250 while I'm sitting here, or is that moving without?
We did the was the amendment to delete, and do we now have to have an amendment to add?
Mr. Chairman, you need to first do whatever you're going to do with this bill, and then bring up Senate File 1250, and then adopt those provisions. I just wanted to add one other thing. I was just noting that the amendment that was adopted to new Section 9 would also be deleted. You probably have a motion to delete that to Section 9
should be the ones
from the A1 amendment. Because that goes along with those previous.
All right, Senator Stogan, so moved. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 1184. Seeing none, 1184 will be laid over for further consideration. Next will be Senate File 1250. So then Senator Stogan will move a delete all amendment as previously described by Mr. Knopf. Is there any question on that? Okay, seeing no further discussion, we'll act on the Scogan Amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair, I ask that Senate File 1250 as amended now be
moved
to
pass. And
do you need to see it first?
The Committee on State and Local Government.
State and Local Government. Thank you.
Discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vargas. Senator Stogan. Mr. Vargas, are you going to, are you or Mr. Meyer going to deal with 1312?
Your handouts were at Senate File number 1312. Senator Chaudhry?
Mr. Chair, this is another DNR, the DNR omnibus, excuse me, the DNR technical bill. This is the Senate file that will be the omnibus environment policy bill. And with me to go over this will be Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The provisions of 1312 are technical corrections in nature, dealing with several provisions, one from parks, one from ecological services, fish and wildlife, and also waters.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move an author's amendment on this to delete Section 5.
Committee will look to Section 5. You'll find that on page 2, bottom of page 2, and the top part of page 3.
Senator, are we taking all of that out?
Correct.
Okay. That's the author's amendment that is before us. Any questions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. The bill before you, I'm just going to go through section by section. Section 1 is expanding our expedited permanent rulemaking authority to, you'll see there, a 97A, 97B, and 97C, dealing with zones, permit area boundaries, spawning beds, fish preserves, the ability to select hunters and anglers for areas, registration of game or fish, prevent, control, wildlife disease, errors and emissions and rules. These are expedited rulemaking processes that we do on a regular basis. They're the mundane decisions that we need to do in order to establish fishing seasons, hunting seasons, spawning areas, and things like that. So we're trying to expedite our abilities, our authorities there. Section 2 is similar. You're seeing we're looking for the authority to designate waters or infested waters. You'll see beginning on lines 2.2 to 2.4. If the water is highly likely to be infested by aquatic invasive species, and then 2.13, the designation shall be by written order published in the state register. This is in order to allow us to act quickly and decisively to designate waters once they become infested so that our authorities and rules will be established on those water bodies. Section 3, required rules, you can see we're taking out infested, the words infested waters, and just designating prohibited invasive species. It's a clarification. Section 4 deals with that same clarification on the expedited rulemaking process. Section 5 was some duplicative language that we're trying to clarify a situation with our parks permits to allow us to sell them for 12 months when they would be validated. Upon reading the language and working through what we were looking to do, it was determined that we did not need to make that change, so we wanted to keep that. Section 6, dealing with our authorities to validate, previously said validate annual state park permits. We want to be able to have commissioner written orders to deal with alternative means to validate state park permit, daily permits as well. We're looking at what we call, and no pun to Senator Saxog, an Iron Ranger for our park system, where you would go in, similar to the parking meters over the AA lot, you would punch in a number, put in your money, get a receipt, which would be your daily park permit, rather than have somebody there to have to sell a daily sticker. So we need the authority to do that under commissioner's orders. Section 7 is really clarifying a provision that passed last session dealing with military personnel on leave. There were two provisions that passed into law allowing veterans on leave to enter into state parks without charge. The one that was signed into law last is the one that passes, or the one that sticks. That allows them to put their active military leave papers on their dashboard and utilize that as a way to enter the park or to be in the park for free. We don't want to encourage that. We don't want that to be in statute. What we're trying to have them do, this will allow them to come into the visitor center, show their papers, get a sticker like everybody else, stick it on their car. Data privacy issues and everything else, we don't want people even to think that that's okay. It would be, but we don't want to be responsible for people having their orders stolen or breaking in their cars or anything like that. Spoke with Senator Vickerman. I think he's comfortable with this not having to go to his committee because of that, because of the clarification. Section 8, we're extending the sunset provision for the Mineral Management Advisory Committee, Minerals Coordinating Committee, I should say, from 2007 to 2011. This is a committee that we use to deal with minerals activities throughout the state. Section 9 is a technical change that comes out of a task force within the Met Council dealing with water plans, water supply plans. Rather than having two plans submitted, one to the Met Council, one to the DNR, that are essentially the same information, we're just going to require one plan to be submitted to meet both of those requirements. Jim Japs is here if we have more questions on that. Section 10 deals with planning activities. Section 10 is part of that bill, the same technical change for the water reporting. Section 11 also, there's some changes there. And then the repealer that we have here is Mr. Knopf, could you help me with the repealer? I don't have that right in front of me.
Well, nobody does. Nobody does. Just yell it out, Carol.
That's the other military personnel.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yes, that is the law that passed into the session or into law last. Didn't ring a bell with me, sorry. So we're just that's what we need to repeal to replace the other language that's there. And that military thing, it's interesting. If you look on the internet and in the statute books, they actually publish both versions of the language. You don't see that too often, so it might be something you want to see. So we're trying to straighten that out. Mr. Chair, members, that was a quick run through, but all of this is technical in nature, and with the timeline your committee's on tonight, I thought I would try to do it as fast as possible.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Parisel.
I'm slightly confused about Section 9. Is that water plan supposed to be submitted from the supplier to DNR or to Met Council then? Because you mentioned that there were multiple requirements.
Mr. Chair, Senator Parisel, why don't I have Jim Japs here to answer that you can answer all the questions on that.
Identify yourself, please.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, I'm Jim Japs. I'm the Assistant Director for the DNR Division of Waters. Senator Parisel, there's just one plan. We have one set of guidelines, and that satisfies two requirements. Currently in the metropolitan area, there's a provision in 103G, and that's found in Section 9 of this bill, for public water suppliers serving more than 1,000 population. And then in Section 11, under the statute 473, there's a requirement the Metropolitan Council has for having a water supply plan be a component of their comprehensive plan. And we have one set of guidelines that satisfies both of those requirements. So it's just one plan. And what this bill does is it takes the requirements from Section 11, the Met Council's comp plan provisions, and puts them in Section 9 under the department's 103G.
Thank you, Mr. Jeff. Any other questions?
Seeing none, Mr. Chair, you can lay this over for okay, well, there's a suggestion on the rulemaking part of this bill as well, Mr. Knopf.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Shotter, I guess it's kind of up to you on how you want to handle this. One of the methods, if you want to use this for your omnibus vehicle, it does need to go to state and local government at some point in time. You could send it out tonight to state and local government and have them send it back for further work. Put together your omnibus bill on this bill. Or you could send the entire omnibus bill to state and local government. I'm guessing you'd probably do it on it.
Just a question, Mr. Chair, a question for
Mr.
Knopf. Would another option be to remove the rulemaking pieces and put them back on 1250 and just have one vehicle go there? I don't know if it makes more sense to just have one and then leave the rest of it in this committee rather than wait for something to come back, and that would be the committee's, up to the committee's decision.
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, that would be an option, would be to take 1250 again from the table and to put in, I think, just sections 1 and 2. I know section 3 and 4 deal with rules, but they're basically removing rulemaking. I don't think, since it's not creating new rulemaking authority or exemption of rulemaking authority, I don't think that state local government would have to see sections 3 and 4, unless you want them to keep track of the same bill. But it looks like the first two sections and possibly the third four should be removed from here and put into Senate File 1250 instead of the Scogan, I guess, can take those to the state local government to really do.
Mr. Knopf, what about Section 8?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good point. That's not rulemaking. I was just looking at the rulemaking sections, but the expiration of a advisory group like that would also be in purview of the state and local government.
So, Mr. Chair, I will move that sections 1, 2, and 8 be amended on to Senate File 1250.
Mr. Knopf, do we need 3 and 4 included in that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as I'm thinking about this, it looks to me like they might be part and parcel with Section 1. In that you want them to travel the same, because if you look at clause 2 and subdivision or section 1, so I think it would be good to put 1 through 4 and section 8. And what you need to do here then is delete them, the motion to delete them from this bill, recall Senate File 1250, and then add those also as an amendment.
You're looking at me, Mr. Knopf, like I would understand what you just said.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, while you have this bill in front of you, I think what you should do is delete sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 8 from this bill, and then lay it on the table, and then take Senate File 1250, which has already been voted on to pass and reconsidered, vote on Senate File 1250. So you're going to have a few motions here, excuse me, but
that's fine,
so we can get through this.
Let's start with the delete motion
on
this bill.
Yes,
Senator Chaudhry will move that... on Senate File number 1312, we will delete sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 8. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Mr. Chairman, do you want to move the motion? Senator Frederickson, if you'll help me with the next motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the vote whereby Senate File 1250 was recommended to pass be reconsidered.
We have a motion to reconsider Senate File 1250. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? 1250 is now on the table. Is that right? Senator Chaudhry.
Move that sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 8 from Senate File 1312 be amended on to Senate File 1250.
That is the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And now, Senator Chaudhry, could you move Senate File 1250 to the appropriate committee?
I move that Senate File 1250 be recommended and passed and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
That is the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
And so, Mr. Chair, you just need to lay over 1312.
It's laid over.
Mr. Chair, we would like to take Senate File 260.
Senator Sachsauger will move the subcommittee report on Senate File 260. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by the way, all three of these bills came out of the Forestry Subcommittee. I'd like to thank those members of that subcommittee that spent some hours on that. Senate File 260 is a bill that will give some financial relief to on timber permitting to some logging contractors in northern Minnesota. With me today is Scott Dane of the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers to go over the bill and answer any questions that the committee might have.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please introduce yourself.
My name is Scott Dane. I'm the Executive Director for the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers in Minnesota, representing the independent truckers and loggers in Minnesota. The timber industry is facing an unprecedented crisis right now with the collapse of the markets throughout the state of Minnesota. in speaking to multi-generational logging families, they've expressed that they've never seen it this bad in Minnesota. Prices have dropped about two-thirds of what they were 12 months ago. What this has created is a volume of timber contracts, particularly Minnesota state timber contracts, that are overvalued and cannot be harvested under the current market rates. This bill that we've got before you asks that you allow the loggers who hold those permits under certain conditions to voluntarily relinquish those permits back to the state of Minnesota and apply the down payment that they have securing those timber permits as credits towards future sales. This would do two things. It would remove the financial hardship that these people are already suffering through with from an additional 15% loss and penalty. But more importantly, it would take that volume of state wood that will not be harvested, that's a fact, and encourage them to turn it in this year and reintroduce that and put it back on the market at current market rates that can continue to support the DNR forest management plan, harvest plan, as well as the logger and mill operations in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bickerman.
Mr. Chair, somebody who's been fighting desperately for the last 2 days to try to find some money, is this going to be a lot of money that we will lose? Senator Sexton, maybe you would like.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, there's a fiscal note on that should have come to you that you should have got as part of your. Anybody see such a thing? I have a fiscal note, and it's relating to the House bill. Chief author David Dill. Do you have copies?
It's the only copy you can make copies of.
And it shows the total cost to the state at being.
If I could interject here, Mr. Chairman, Senator Vickerman, excuse me, I'm sorry. We just received this afternoon and took a look at it. And the initial fiscal note actually shows a potential over a five-year period of $17 million. That's the initial note. However, in talking to the DNR, it's going to have to be reviewed and brought back if this bill goes to the Finance Committee. And to be honest with you, initial calculations from others doing the analysis show it in the $2 to $5 million range. So that's the best I can give you right now. But I don't think that it would actually represent the $17 million that this note.
Those are fiscal.
Is that fiscal note from the department?
Yes, it is. It was provided Tuesday evening, okay. Mr. Chairman. All
right. Mr. Chairman. So there's a price tag on it. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, what are the surrounding circumstances on the tremendous price drop?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, there's a rapid escalation in the value of timber over the last couple of years since 2004, and that was being driven by the housing boom throughout the United States and the creative financing that the lending institutions put in place to support this housing boom. So our industries in Minnesota, particularly the OSB, Oriented Strand Board Mills, were producing product as fast as they could. And as an example, it was selling retail at about $28 a sheet. It's less than $5 a sheet today with the collapse of the housing market. People were buying timber based on the market escalating, the demand that was there, and then with the collapse of it, that's created this high volume of timber that's unmarketable at this time.
Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion on Senate File 260.
Mr. Chair, where's the bill voting here?
We'll have to go to Finance, unless there are any other policy committees that need to review.
Sexhawk, I'm not trying to kill your bill. I'm just trying to figure out. I'm more than willing to let it go if Finance can figure out how to do it.
Mr. Chair. Senator Rickman, I know you aren't, and I think that this bill is probably best sent to Senator Anderson's committee, and I'm sure she'll deal with it. But Mr. Chair, this bill is moving separately, and so I'd move that Senate File 26 to be recommended to pass and sent to Environmental Finance.
Senator Saxog moves that Senate File 260 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Further discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dane.
Thank you.
Senate File 420.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and we have a subcommittee report that needs to be approved here, too. I'd like to move that subcommittee.
Saxon moves the subcommittee report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment that has been worked out to clarify the definition of firewood that we need to discuss before we take any type of final action. At the Chair's direction, we can go over the bill and then the amendment, or adopt the amendment and then take up the bill. And with me tonight's Bob Meyer, who's going to help me go through this bill.
Go ahead and move the amendment.
I move that amendment.
Senator Saxog moves the A2.
The A2 amendment.
Discussion. Why don't you explain it?
Mr. Meyer will explain the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members, in the subcommittee, we did substantial work on the bill after the first time it was up with some questions about definitions, penalties, what approved firewood means. After the committee, working with Senate counsel, it was determined that the clearer definition, perhaps, for the wood to be used for firewood would be that as used in a campfire, as defined in Section 88.01, Subdivision 25, which actually is the definition of a campfire. I don't have that in front of me. I know Senate Research does. I'm sorry. I was working with Senate Research, not Senate Council. I apologize.
We should probably hear that definition.
Mr. Chairman, the definition of a campfire means a fire set for cooking, warming, or ceremonial purposes, which is not more than 3 feet in diameter by 3 feet high, and has had ground 5 feet from the base of the fire cleared for all combustible material. And how this works, and the amendment isn't really much different than what was originally in the bill from the subcommittee. There's an exemption from a permit for a fire that reaches that, or for a fire of that type. Otherwise, you need to have a permit to basically have a start fire that's larger than that. And what this does is instead of using the exemption, it actually just defines campfire.
Chair, I talked about this issue last time we brought it up. I have a cabin up north, and I burned my own wood for my own, I don't know, 9 acres. And I burned my own, and the kids have a big ring, and then they have a campfire. Is that, we're not talking about that, are we? On private property?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, the firewoods that we're talking about, the restrictions on firewood in this bill only are on state lands, lands administered by the DNR. It does not deal with private lands at all. It will not deal with the wood you're buying. The other part of the puzzle that we haven't talked about, but we discussed when we're in other committees, is the work that Department of Ag does on the other side of the equation, dealing with once there are infestation zones established, wood and other sources coming into the state. That's where the Department of Agriculture takes over and is working very hard. You see, I handed out a bookmark. This is going to be mailed out to all of our registered campground participants in their actual permit. It talks about help keep our trees safe, don't move firewood, buy it where you burn it. This is actually published by Ag, and it has a hotline on there. There's a lot of education work going on. If you go on the DNR website now, on the right-hand corner, there'll be a page that talks, a link that'll take you right to firewood information. There's a whole kit of information prepared dealing with firewood, bumper stickers, cars, T-shirts that we're going to be working with
up.
Local
Hold
units of government.
The cover.
Oh, packed marshmallows, not firewood, yeah. I mean, the reason why we need to get this bill passed and get it to the floor as soon as possible is to protect our forest, prevent the infestation of the emerald ash borer to the devastation of our ash trees throughout the whole state. This package is done with USDA, Department of Agriculture. Our bill just talks about state lands, but it is a lot larger than state lands. It's working with Ag, working with USDA, working with the other states where the infestation is and where it's coming from. The reason why we're focusing on firewood is it's been identified. We've learned from Wisconsin and others that's where the bugs came from, people moving firewood throughout other parts of the state. We have millions of visitors traveling from southern parts of the state to the northern parts of the state. We need to educate them. We need to let them know you can't bring firewood unless it's approved into the parks. Otherwise, we're going to lose millions and millions of trees and entire forests, which are not only there for us to recreate and also provide water quality, habitat, conservation, hunting, everything else that's so important to the residents of Minnesota. So one of the things we need to do with this bill is pass it as soon as possible. It's our desire to move it out of here and get it off of the floor well in advance of the camping season. You'll see some of the other changes in Section 2 of the bill. The bill has an effective date upon signature, but the ban will not go into place until after the commissioner issues an order. We're looking to do a by written order published in the State Register on what approved firewood is. So I will have a draft for members to see in their hands on the floor what will be published in the State Register days after signature of the bill, so you can see what the actual wood that will be approved are going to be. Local sources. We're working with local vendors right now in our parks, around our parks in our regions, to make sure that they're certified, make sure that they have the process, they're aware of the process to use to sell wood. They'll give a receipt to the person who buys the wood. They'll come into the park. Do you have any firewood? Yes, here's the certification validation form for it. That's what we're looking at doing. So it's a huge threat. We all talk about invasive species, Eurasian water milfoil, curly leaf pondweed, things like that. I don't want to be sitting here talking about what the emerald ash borer did to our trees in 2 years. I want to make sure that we do what we need to do right now to stop that. So
why don't you talk about the common impact that the ash borer has on trees?
The impact, what it does to the trees, it will go in and I can bring up Susan Burks, our technical specialist here, basically bore into the bark and stop the nutrients from flowing, but Susan can give you a little bit of that background as well, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Chairman, members, I'm Susan Burks, a forest health specialist with the DNR. This is a small beetle very closely related to the two-line chestnut borer and the bronze birch borer. The adult lays eggs, and the larvae will tunnel in and feed immediately under the bark. It then can, overwinter and emerge and then fly to other trees. It attacks all species of ash, and it does not prefer. Normally, this particular group of insects likes dead and dying or stressed trees, and this particular insect likes live and healthy, so it's killing all ash, all forest types, all ages where ash occurs.
What do you have to do once you find it?
That is going to be up to the Department of Agriculture, and it depends on kind of where it comes in. If it comes in at a point source that we can isolate fairly well, there's a good chance that we might be able to eradicate that. If we find it in a more broad, infestation where we have a lot of ash resource there, we may not be able to do anything. But as I said, that is under the authority of the Department of Agriculture, and that will be up to their decision.
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear a description of what has to be done. Does nothing have to be done?
And do you want to talk about that, Gary, as far as Because it is going to be.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, if there is an infestation found, it will require the removal of many, many trees, half a mile, mile, the circumference, if not more, depending on the infestation, to reduce, eliminate the chance of spreading. Just like we're facing right now, we're dealing with up in Senator Stump's district with the deer, eradicating the herd for a certain area. We would have to eradicate ash trees in a certain area to make sure that they would not be susceptible to spreading an infestation, reduce the ability for products to be moved out of those areas. It will not be pretty at all.
Did we have to do this, go to this extent for Dutch elm disease?
Chairman and members, Dutch elm disease was already fairly well established within the state before we really found out about it and had a chance to do much of anything. This is still, the emerald ash borer is quite a ways away, so we have the opportunity to prevent it moving in. So it's really a completely different situation. The other thing is that Dutch elm disease, when it did go through in the 70s, and again, just we had an outbreak in 2004, it didn't take all of the elm out. It left quite a few of them. And back in the 70s, because of aggressive management in some of our communities, up to 40 to 50% of the elm survived. But in the Detroit area where the emerald ash borer is going through, they've got nearly 100% mortality of the ash in those areas.
On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being a low-impact disease, 10 being a very high-impact disease, trees. Where is Dutch elm disease? Where is the emerald ash borer?
Chairman and members, because of the fact that Dutch elm disease, does not take out all of the elm, I would put it somewhere between 5 and, 7 or somewhere in there. Emerald ash borer is taking out by far the majority of the ash as it's going through, so it's more like a 9 or a 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, did you say if someone came to a state park with wood, they would have to prove certification of some kind? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, yes. And this will be clearly laid out also on our website and information that they get. They will have to make sure that they can show that wood is from an approved source. We will be working with the vendors in the area to make sure that they have the validations necessary to show that their wood is approved.
Assuming it's not, they're already in your state park. Has the damage been done?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, this is going to occur right as they're entering into the park system. More times than not, that wood is going to be from their home, or the worst case would be a person coming from out of state. We'll be working with them to make sure that what's there in the process. We'll also have procedures in place to confiscate that wood. You'll see on the language and the penalty lines 1.32, a violation of this section is subject to confiscation of firewood, and then after the first year, a petty misdemeanor. So we will have the ability to confiscate that wood upon being notified or upon learning that it's not approved, and we will have quarantine procedures, disposal procedures in place to deal with that wood at that point in time.
Mr. Chair, we have a couple of additional people to give testimony.
I'm sorry, we're seeing.
Thank you.
Senator Bickerman, did you have something?
Chair, Mayor, that all I wanted to be sure that people understand what's going on here. So my phone don't ring when I'm taking an afternoon nap and matter all the hell because they didn't know about it. I've told you that before. Be sure they know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bickerman, and Chairman Chaudhry has also expressed a lot of concern about this issue. We are doing all we can to, we're already kicking off the campaign in anticipation of selling or passing the language. We're going to make sure every person that has a reservation through the park system is notified more than once. There will be numbers, there will be billboards, there will be bumper stickers and postcards and whatever we can do. And I'll give them my number, not yours, all right?
Call you.
Yeah. Is the call center now informing people of the need?
Mr. Chair, members, on the website, there is a phone number they can call. We do are making sure that our help desk, our information center, has the latest up-to-date information on what's going on as well.
Oh,
on what's been
taking place. The call reservation center. People call to make a reservation. Are the service reps now telling every person who calls in about this?
Mr. Chair, members, John Lilly from our Parks Recreation Department says yes.
And is it on the website now?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Is it on the homepage of the website?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just for my information, is it in the burning that the emerald ash borer leaves and infests other ash, or is it simply by bringing it across the border or bringing it into an area where there are trees that there will be an infestation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the beetle transferred lives underneath the bark, so any bark trees that are down are where they're being transported and are being moved. So you would bring in firewood, it sits there, it allows the invasive species to escape and thereby establish itself. So that's the biggest problem. We don't want to be in the business of making sure people know what oak versus elm versus ash versus birch are. We just want to make sure they know what's approved, what's allowed, and what's not. Other states have gone through other lengths. This is the preliminary step, but not the last time you're going to hear about wood, about transport of wood from other states and things like that. We need to do this now to get our hands around the people bringing wood into the forested areas of the state this year. It's also, Mr. Chair, members, we have been contacted by Campground Resort Association. They are supportive of it. They want to help us however we can get our message across. And other hospitality industries are also aware of what's going on and want to do whatever they can to help.
Mr. Chairman, does every permit to harvest wood, every person that wants to harvest wood on public lands have to have a permit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, by harvest do you mean for commercial sale?
No, for personal use.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, I believe there's a limit, upper threshold you need to have in order to take wood. If you want to go in and take some wood for camping?
The situation is usually in the fall, I've seen little articles in the paper, and a lot of people up in our area go on state land to harvest firewood. The article usually say such and such a place you can go and harvest firewood. I can't remember if they have to actually get a permit from the department to go do that. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, yes, you would need to get a permit. The price of the permit or what that permit costs you would be dependent upon how much you want to take.
Okay.
We work with those folks, much like other issues, bow buyers we've talked about in subcommittee as well. I'm not going there, though. So.
What's the status in the House?
Mr. Chair, members, this bill will be heard in the full policy committee here in the coming days. It has been heard and passed the Game, Fish, and Forestry subcommittee.
Mr. Chair?
I
would move that Senate File 420 be recommended to pass and sent to state and local government.
Further discussion on the motion, Senator Anderson?
Well, I know the department is carrying some money in their budget for this, a small amount in their budget, correct? So it's going to come to finance then. It doesn't say there's an appropriation attached to it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, we do have some money for the education and the handling of the wood itself. This piece of it does not have direct fiscal impacts. So the funding, I believe it's $55,000 each year, is to help us do an extra full-blown statewide education campaign and deal with the disposal of the wood. We would hope that we could move this bill to the floor at some point in time rather than with the finance bill.
Mr. Chair, I understand you want to do it quickly. That shouldn't be a problem.
On the motion. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
438. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 438 has a subcommittee report involved with it that I'd like to move.
Pass the subcommittee report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Now we're working off of the engrossment 438CE.
Correct, Mr. Chair. So Mr. Chair and members, all the language is in one place. And with me tonight is Bob Tomlinson and Wayne Brandt to go over this bill, help answer any questions the committee might have. But before we begin to go over the bill, I'd like to make a motion to delete sections 5 and 6 relating to Balbine and section 10 relating to an industry biomass objective.
Okay, Senator Saxon makes that motion. Questions, discussion?
Mr. Chairman, did you ever say the section began like 5 and 6?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mr.
Ten.
Chairman, yeah, send 10.
5, 6, and 10. You got that? Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Minutes adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Tomlinson now, who's going to review the first part of the bill.
Mr. Chair, Bob Tomlinson, DNR Division of Forestry. This started out as our forestry bill, our department's forestry bill, and there were three components to it. One was the establishment of the Forest Resource Assessment Products and Services Account, which is found in Section 7 of the bill. I'll bring your attention to that first. Basically, there we're setting up a special Forest Resource Assessment Products and Services Account, which basically brings in, as I testified earlier in a previous committee, rolls in three different accounts into one and allows more flexibility in managing both revenues and expenditures across fiscal years and bienniums, and consolidates those accounts into the one item there. The sections 1, 2, 3, and 4 all pertain to the establishment of the account that's actually set up in Section 7. Sections 5 and 6 of the bill were dealing with the second component, which was the Balbine provisions, which Senator Saxog has removed from the bill. We're going to hopefully come back to you next year with that better thought out provisions after we have some discussions with the Balsam Bow Buyers Partnership during the interim and discussing those changes. And the other one related to the repealer related to the Forest Resources Council is found in Section 8 of the bill on page 3, and there you're basically extending the Forest Resources Council and the other other parts of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act out to the year 2017.
The rest of the bill is sent. Mr. Brandt will explain, Mr. Chair.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Minnesota Forest Industries members are primary manufacturers of forest products, paper mills, sawmills, engineered wood products facilities. Minnesota Timber Producers Association members are loggers, truckers, small sawmills, allied businesses. The remaining provisions in the bill are a package of items that were developed through a task force that was put together to come up with recommendations to the legislature on items that can be done to help our industry get back on its economic feet. I won't belabor the industry conditions, which have been very difficult. Some one-third of the productive capacity has been idled for more than 6 months with significant impacts. The task force came up with a variety of recommendations for legislative language, some appropriations, which will need to be reviewed in the Finance Committee ultimately, and some other provisions. If you'd like me to explain them, I'd be happy to, or I could just stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't you just highlight the...
Sure. Mr. Tomlinson highlighted Section 8. That's an important practice of sustainable forestry as utilized through the Sustainable Forest Resources Act is vital to the industry as well as the state's environment. So continuing the Sustainable Forest Resources Act is very important. Section 9 deals with transportation issue relative to truck weights and would allow what is currently allowed for hauling wood from the woods to the mills with an additional axle, as you can see in that previously passed provision, to apply to hauling finished products from the mills to the marketplace. We estimate that the combining of the new language with the existing language will result in roughly a 15% savings in the amount of diesel fuel that's used in transporting our products, as well as cost savings to the system. We think that the that provides benefits to us as well as benefits to the environment. Sections 11 and 12 are provisions, are tax provisions. The first one dealing with the corporate franchise tax, which is particularly beneficial to our industry. This is the single sales factor issue that you've heard about for a number of years. We're one of the classic examples. We have high payroll, huge capital investments, and the bulk of our products are sold outside the boundaries of the state. In the case of paper, only about 25% of the paper that we manufacture is sold within Minnesota. The rest of it is exported. So those jobs and dollars come back to our state for employment. Section 12 would convert the current rebate for the sales tax on capital equipment to an upfront exemption for our industry. We are a very capital intensive. Section 13 is another tax provision which would remove the sales tax on skidder tires. Skidder tires cost about $20,000 a set. They're about 4 feet wide in most instances, quite tall, and it's a significant cost item. Then the package of appropriations are there, which are targeted, and some of these come out of the general fund. Some of them are one-time funds, and then subdivision two are items coming from timber sale receipts through the forest management investment account. I'm sure we'll have ample opportunity to discuss them. I know I've already discussed them with Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Tomlinson has some additional information on the appropriations that maybe you want to have briefly review.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll speak first off. All of the items that are listed in Section 14, with the exception of Item E in Subdivision 1, were included in the Governor's budget recommendations and basically mirror those. The first Subdivision 1 basically deals with private land management, which we testified before different committees, the importance of trying to better manage the private lands in the state. And that's for $1.5 million a year out of the general fund, which will help us achieve about a million acre increase in the number of stewardship plans written for private lands by 2015, and also try to certify private lands to about 20% of the 120,000 or so private landowners that are out there. I would jump back to the second page, and Dave Zemeta from the council can speak to subdivision one, items B, C, and D. But going back to the second page, that subdivision two, the forest management investment account, the $3.167 million, there is more full cost accounting relative to those activities that we're currently doing that are consistent with the intention of the forest management investment account. The 700, the item B is $750,000 per year, which would be hiring 15 new field foresters to basically work on timber sales throughout the state. We believe that they will probably bring in about that much or more in revenue by putting that those investments in. Item C is $1 million. We're doing stand improvement work more stand improvement work that we're currently doing. It would be non-commercial type of work where there's not revenue produced off those the activities associated with that. The $1.1 million in item D is for a catch-up, if you will, on roads and bridge work that we really need to help manage the 2,000-plus mile road system that we have in the state forest throughout the state. And the $400,000 in item E is for the accelerating our efforts relative to gathering data and gathering good information in the states through our continuous stand inventory assessment projects. We basically will, we will shorten the cycle of, currently we have 4 million acres about of state forest land that we keep inventory on. There's about 230,000 stands that we've identified within that 4 million acres. We currently visit those about once every 15 years. And we feel that we'd be better off to visit at shorter time frames, since we're moving that up once every 10 years with that investment.
All right, I see state and local government, I see transportation, I see taxes, and finance, some missed committees.
Mr. Chair, did you want Mr. Zabetta to talk about those other three sections?
Well, I was just trying to identify the issues. We're extending a council, so I'm seeing state and local government.
This clearly has transportation, because I carry milk bills and you couldn't help exceed.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure.
Limitations, so
Section 9 would probably send it to the Transportation Committee, I would guess.
Right. And then taxes with the capital equipment stuff. And then finance with all the appropriations. I'm wondering, with some of these deadlines looming, that whether finance would be good to go to finance first, so they can hear it. It's up to you, but
okay. Well, I do, Mr. Chair. I do have one more amendment.
Okay.
I'd like to move the A2 amendment. This is language from Senate file 850, and that it was included over in the House, you have the draft amendment this time. It's the A2 amendment, and with me tonight is Gary Cirkvenik, who's going to briefly go over the bill and answer any questions. The amendment, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Cirkvenik, and I'm representing the Laurentian Energy Authority, which asks Senator Saxhog to carry this amendment. And basically, the amendment clarifies existing state law granting counties the option to sell timber either as appraised or as scale. Currently, and that's for all species. This would allow an efficient and fair process for among other things, biomass removal, which is what we're interested in at the Laurentian Energy Authority. You may recall that the Laurentian Energy Authority is a biomass facility that generates 35 megawatts of renewable energy located at Virginia and Hibbing at the public utilities. St. Louis County, where most of our biomass comes from, supports this change, as does the Minnesota Association of County Land Commissioners. It basically reduces administrative work, allows the counties the option of either selling as appraised or scaled. And currently, to give you an example, the U.S. Forest Service sells most of their timber under this method.
Did we hear this as a separate bill?
Pardon me, Mr. Chair?
Did we hear this as a separate bill?
No.
Was it introduced as a separate bill?
Yes.
Yes.
But later?
Yeah.
Chair, I honestly don't understand what this terminology means. Could you just say it in plain English?
Sure. There is basically when a county puts up for sale timber, say on a 40-acre tract, they'll send out a group of foresters to assess what's on that tract of land. There may be 1,000 cords of aspen or 500 cords of conifers, and then they put a minimum price. It goes out for a bid, and loggers or companies buy it, whoever's awarded it, under the way St. Louis County, for example, currently does it, say they price it at $40 as the winning bid for aspen, and they're estimating at 1,000 cords. When the wood is cut, there's tickets that go with the wood, so they count and scale as the wood leaves the site and is delivered to a customer. So the county then has an accurate running total of how much wood is there. So there's a lot of administrative paperwork associated with it. This gives a county the option to sell like the Forest Service does, and some counties currently do this. And that is, they say there's 1,000 cords, here's the price. If it shows up short, that's to the benefit of the county. And if it shows up long, it's to the benefit of the purchaser. It's a way to reduce paperwork, give counties another tool in their toolbox in managing the forest. St. Louis County's goal, if this is passed, according to the land commissioner, is to sell roughly 50% of their total timber as scaled, the old-fashioned way, or as appraised.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and this is DNR-owned, state-owned land, managed by the county-owned. This is DNR-owned land that's managed by the county? How
does
the county and state interact on this?
Mr. Bennett. Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, this is county tax forfeited land. I believe it's classified, even though I'm not an expert, as Class B lands, state Class B lands.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, we had the issue kind of brought up the other day, too. This is land that the state holds title to and trusts for the taxing district. Commissioner of Revenue actually holds title to the land, but it is managed.
What's the difference between appraised and scaled?
Mr. Chairman, as scaled would be the county forester would be at the end of the sale making sure the loads are accurate, they're scaling exactly what's taken off the land and pricing it according to the bid. As appraised would be, they wouldn't be going through that administrative work at the back end. They would put more work into accurately appraising how much wood is on that site, put it up for bid. The bidder then buys what was appraised. If it's less than appraised, they still pay the appraised amount.
Mr. Chair, if I bought 40 acres, do I cut all the trees down?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it depends upon the forest plan for that 40 acres. The county forester would go out and say, for example, there's maple and we don't want you to cut the maple. There's aspen, we want you to cut the aspen. So there is a county plan for each site and that the forester and the county land commission develops.
Okay, any other discussion on the amendment? All right, seeing none, on the A2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
So, Mr. Chair, at your recommendation, I'd move that Senate File 438 be, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to Environment Finance?
Committee on Finance.
Committee on
Finance.
Committee on Finance. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think that'll work fine. We've heard most of this already, in our committee.
Right.
And, you know, we've heard several presentations about the details of these requests. But if we have the bill in front of us, we can make sure we incorporate it into our bill and then send it back. Let's take the finance part out and send the rest of it on to the policy committee.
That'd be great.
All right.
Okay.
That'll work.
Mr. Stump?
I was just thinking that I don't know the exact deadlines of the transportation, but it probably wouldn't be in the transportation finance bill, so it doesn't matter. This is probably the best way.
Right.
Well, Mr. Chair, the tax, I don't know what the deadline is for the tax bill either.
I think it's the latter part of all our budget bills. So.
Okay, further discussion on the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Sharon?
Good evening.
Senate File 1343.
Good evening. Good evening, Chairman Chaudhry. I'm here presenting Senate File 1343. This is a bill that really speaks only to shifting responsibility for forest management in the community itself, in within municipalities, from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to the Department of Natural Resources, to match more clearly both departments' missions. In 2003, there was a statute that assigned pest control responsibility to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and it was amended at that time to more strongly focus on potentially damaging invasive pests, some of which we've talked about tonight, such as the not-yet-established emerald ash borer. Those changes corresponded better with the historic missions of the two agencies, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture overseeing and managing pests not yet established, on the one hand, those not established yet in the state, so prevention, and then the Department of Natural Resources, which was overseeing management of forest pests permanently established in the state, like elm disease. The bill further clarifies the respective pest management missions of the agencies. The Departments of Agriculture and Natural Resources are supporting each other in this transition. With that, I'd like to turn over the microphone with your permission to Bob Tomlinson, who is the Assistant Director of the DNR Forestry Department, for any questions you may have about this bill.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, members, Bob Tomlinson, DNR Division of Forestry. That was a wonderful introduction, so I don't need to do that. If you'd like, I could walk through the bill. I am prepared to go through it section by section, and we could probably, might be the best way to do it. And then I have with me as well Susan Burks. She's done a lot of work on the bill over the past several months, and Gear Friso from the Department of Agriculture as well. They answer very specific questions that I'm not able to relative to it. But why don't I just get right into it. There's Section 1, basically, of the bill, avoid potential conflicts between MDA authorities over terrestrial invasive species described under 18G.12 and the DNR authorities over aquatic invasive species, that the DNR maintains that authority relative to the aquatics. Section 2 of the bill maintains authorities MDA currently has under 18G.16 subdivision 5 and 18G.16 subdivision 8. Section 3 of the bill updates 84D to reflect the changes back in 18G. Section 4 of the bill is where we start to get into the DNR responsibilities of it and stuff, and basically Section 4 adds a definition, if you will, for community forest. Section 5 The bill recognizes the importance of urban and community forestry by giving the Commissioner of Natural Resources general authority to hire staff, provide technical assistance for the purpose of enhancing the sustainability of urban and community forest resources. excuse me. Also, with regards to charges for DNR services, Section 6 adds text to recognize the value of benefits other than timber may be calculated into the transaction for those charges. In Chapter 7 of the bill, expands the forestry practices that can be cost-shared under the Minnesota Relief Program. The Minnesota Relief Program was established a couple of decades ago, probably, and was focused primarily on energy conservation, tree planting. We'd like to be able to use that program, the umbrella and of that program, if you will, and the administrative capacity that we built up with that for other granting that we do with for oak wilt control and other things like that. Section 8 of the bill adds climate to the definition of forest resources in recognition of the benefits provided by trees in enhanced air quality and reduced urban heat island effects. Section 9 of the bill updates the definition of forest pest. And then Section 10 of the bill adds a parallel definition for shade tree pests. Separate definitions we feel are needed because of the specific references to forest pests in Statutes 89.039 that governs the Forest Management Investment Account. I'll leave it at that. Section 11 refers to the previous definitions given for community forest under 84.D. And Section 12 of the bill adds a definition for shade tree originally taken from 18G.16. Chapter 89.01 begins with Section 13, which clarifies both the need and the authority to develop best management practices to address actual and potential damage to forest pests. Section 14 specifies forest pest and shade tree protection as responsibilities of the DNR commissioner. Section 15 adds text to better reflect the breadth of planning work done in cooperation with DNR's partners. Chapter 89.51 begins with Section 16, where we update the statute citations. Section 17 corrects the previous typographical error. We wanted it to be emergent, not emergency, as you note there. And add text to reflect the parallel definitions of forest and shade tree pests. Section 18 adds text to the definition of forest land to include the range of benefits provided by urban and community forests. Chapter 89.52 is dealt with in Section 19, where we again add text to reflect the parallel definitions of forest and shade tree pests. We're moving on to Chapter 89.53. Section 20 of the bill adds shade tree pest control to the DNR's current forest pest control responsibilities. This is a major transfer from MDA. It transfers MDA's 18G language where feasible, and also incorporates shade tree pest control as a parallel activity to the DNR's existing forest pest control whenever possible. Subdivision 2 of the bill on that page requires the DNR to specify what control measures will be applied in the public notices, how we go about that. And Subdivision 3 is a direct transfer from MDA for that. Chapter 89.54 is dealt with in section in the next Section 21. Whereas the term control area was used in 18G, we're changing that to zone of infestation, and it's used in 89.54, Section 21. This change provides consistency in the terminology for both forest and shade tree pests. Chapter 89.55 is dealt with Section 22, which allows the control of pathogens, regardless of the vector that transmits them. Authorizes the commissioner to prevent spread of an established pest to uninfected areas of the state and eliminates the term timber, which is vague in meaning. Chapter 89.56 is dealt with in section 23 of the bill, which adds shade trees to those of commercial timber purposes. And section 24 adds shade trees to existing authorities, as does sections 25 and sections 26 and 27. And section 28 of the bill, it starts dealing with chapter 89.60. It changes the citation to include transferred shade tree authority. In chapter 89.61, it starts to be dealt with in section 29, where we change the citation to include transferred shade tree authority. In chapter 89.62, section 30, in section 30, is a substantive part of the bill. This is the part that transfers responsibility for grant making to control established shade tree pests from MDA to DNR. At the same time, it modifies the program to make shade tree pest control activities parallel the longstanding DNR program for forest pest control. And section 31 transfers this authority to DNR. The certification of tree inspectors from Minnesota Department of Agriculture over to us. In section 32, it maintains the MDA responsibility to control non-forest and invasive species. Chapter 97A.205 is dealt with in section 33, where DNR enforcement officers are already empowered to enforce forest pest statutes. This section adds shade tree enforcement authority as well. And section 34 repeals MDA's authority for control of established shade tree pests, so there is no duplication between MDA and DNR. It also removes a duplicate definition of forest pest. It's a long, it's complicated bill. I like to characterize the bill as a kind of an alignment bill, if you will. We want to try and better align MDA's and DNR's responsibilities and what our strengths are and within these statutes and continue to work very cooperatively together as we have. It shouldn't be looked at as a bill that's necessarily entirely just for invasives, but certainly that's one of the catalysts, if you will, that makes it more urgent to kind of move forward on this now, and more clearly aligns our authorities and our respective agencies with that. So with that, we stand for questions. As I mentioned, I think you have one person or two that we're going to testify, but if there's time.
Do you have some others who would like to testify? Do you want to take time for some additional testifiers?
Are they for the bill or against it?
Four.
I'm out of town.
Minneapolis.
Chairman, I have a question on Ms. Tomlinson. What are the dynamics between the section here about exemptions of 18G and down here 18G 16 and another one are repealed?
I'm sorry.
The exemption section on section 32 and 34. Is there a conflict between those two? Effectively,
Mr. Chair, Senator Pearsall, I'm going to ask Susan Burks to try and respond to that.
Yes, Chairman and members, again, Susan Burks, the Forest Health Specialist. Section 32, this chapter does not supersede the authority of the Department of Agriculture under Chapter 18B. This is, again, recognizing the authority that the Department of Agriculture has to do all survey, containment, eradication, and management of invasive pests that are not yet established in the state. We really wanted to clarify that because there has been some confusion about, you know, what we did within our grant programs and what the Department of Agriculture does. And clearly the authority lies over there, so we wanted to make sure that this statute did not imply that we were assuming that responsibility over invasive forest pests that are not yet established in the state. Section 34 is basically taking that part of 18G that has to do with the shade tree program within the Department of Agriculture, which is just the grant program, community assistance grant program that had been under Department of Agriculture, and shifting that over to the DNR. So that's what Section 34 is doing.
So they, you don't repeal anything having to do with MDA in that section?
Well, we're repealing the part that had been under MDA, that is the shade tree bill. And now that's moving it over into the DNR and has been replaced by this other language.
Thank you. I want to talk.
Mr. Chair, I'm Gear Friso with the Plant Protection Division of Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And if I could just add a little bit more, I think Susan Burks did a very good job of responding. 18G16 was simply the grant or municipal reforestation program that was put in place to deal with Dutch elm disease back in the mid-70s. And so it's resided there. The funding dried up in about 1982. So that piece of the statute has never really been in force. When MinRelief came along, you kind of had two duplicative programs. It just seemed to make good business sense, good environmental sense to align the two programs together under one agency.
One question for Ag. Does this have DNR is going to be administering this now, is that correct? Not you folks?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The grant portion of the program, and there's no funds that's going along with this program, so the enactment of the grant program would be dependent on some funding.
Is this nonetheless going to have a budget impact on your department, positive or negative?
Mr. Chair, there's probably a small positive. We do administer the Municipal Tree Inspector Program, which is primarily an administrative task. We issue the licenses. The training is done by the university, but we do maintain that task. Those duties will transfer with this granting program, so we will save a little bit of money from that standpoint.
So does that make this financial, Mr. Mueller?
How small?
How small?
Mr. Chair, I would guess it's a tenth of an FTE. It's very minor. What we get is a list of people who have gone through the training from the university, and then we simply, based on that list, just issue a license once a year. So it's very, very minor.
Further discussion? Mr. Chairman. Senator Fredrickson.
I do have one word usage amendment. On page 6, line 19, delete such and insert dot. They caught many years ago.
I know.
They cleaned up the language further on in that section, but they missed that one.
On the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 1343. Is there anyone who wishes to testify in opposition to the bill? Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1343 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture. Is that correct?
That's just what I was saying.
Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Committee will turn to Senate File 1137. Senator Chaudhry, you have the.
Mr. Chair, here's what we'll do in the interest of time. I will talk a little bit, very little. And then what we'll do is take testimony from the Northern County Commissioners, who I think are here. Can you raise your hands? And then we will, I think there's three of them. So what I'm going to do is just introduce the bill. We'll hear from Mr. Kemp, and then we'll hear from the three Northern County Commissioners so they don't have to come back. And then what we'll do is set the bill aside, calm down, talk, and hopefully we'll come to some reasonable resolution. Issue of wetlands is never easy. It's never been in the past, and I don't imagine it will be now. We've held two hearings so far on wetlands to talk about some of the issues, the more contemporary issues surrounding wetlands, and some of the problems we have with wetland degradation. We've also heard from Bowser and some of the things that the state of Minnesota has been encountering with wetlands and some of the proposals that Bowser has come up with. Minnesota relies greatly on our wetlands. We rely on them for our wildlife. We rely on our wetlands for biodiversity. We rely on our wetlands to filter our water as a natural method to filter runoff. So back in 1991, the legislature and many of the people here recognized that we had to do something about the degradation of our wetlands because it was having a strong impact on our wildlife and our water quality and our biodiversity. And I think many of the people in this room did a lot of great work on that bill. I can't take any credit for that. I have to admit that in 1991, when you passed this bill, I was more than likely at a kegger. Getting ready for my graduation from St. Olaf College. And it might very well have been near a wetland. And that wetland is probably no longer there. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just going to remind you that we may or may not be taping this.
But, you know, 15, 16 years later, we've come to learn a lot about the impact of the law that you folks passed back then. And one of the most important parts of the law that you passed in 1991 was that we intend for there to be no net loss of our wetlands when we farm, when we develop, when we impact these wetlands, this resource for Minnesota. And what we learned about a week ago from our state agency is that even though we intend for no net loss to occur, we are indeed experiencing net loss of our wetlands. We learned that from Bowser. We learned that from DNR enforcement. We've learned that from private citizens. We've learned that from non-governmental organizations. We have an issue. And I think it's got to be addressed. We've got to do something. And so this bill attempts to do some things that have been affecting our wetlands in terms of our state policy. So what I'm doing in my bill is taking a look at several issues, key issues in the in our wetland policies that seem to be having the greatest impact on our wetlands. The first is our approval process of developing on or near wetlands, and the delineation of wetlands and the determination whether mitigation or replacement is needed. We'll also take a look at one of the things that we saw in one of the PowerPoint presentations, and that is what type of wetlands are actually replaced when under our current law. What is legal to be replaced? A lot of times we're not replacing a wetland with a wetland. Under the law, we're allowed to replace a wetland with a concrete stormwater pond. That's not a wetland. And that's not achieving, or is it in the spirit of our no net loss policy. We also take a look at the de minimis exceptions that we have in our rules. Back then, we took a look at certain acreages which we thought were smaller in nature and didn't need to be part of the replacement requirement. Now, this is not to say that you cannot drain these types of wetlands. They're allowed. But what the de minimis exception gets at is whether this is the type of acreage, this is enough acreage for which you need to replace wetlands. So we're not getting at this. De minimis exception doesn't talk about whether you can drain them with at all. It just says, addresses whether you need to, the threshold with which you need to replace a wetland. And that goes to no net loss as well. How much it impacts no net loss, we honestly don't know. We don't know, because an amount of acreage of 10,000 square feet is exempt. And because it's exempt, we don't know if someone has drained that amount of square footage. That was some of the difficulties we were encountering in our previous two hearings. How much are we losing? We're honestly not sure. Under WACA, or really under our inventory process, we're just honestly not sure. We're trying to rectify some things, but it would really be helpful, even though there are acreages under an exemption, we'd like to know at least if we're losing wetlands that are under the exemption. So we ask that we gather some information on wetland losses that are exempt. And we take a look at how we enforce our wetland losses. And I've got a provision in here that mirrors the Federal Clean Water Act. It is a mechanism that can already be used under a federal act. It just brings it into Minnesota law. Now, there's going to be a lot of discussion about these. A lot of people disagree with the approach. And I do have an amendment that addresses a couple of the nuances, but there's still going to be some discussion about this. So why don't I introduce, move the A1, and then we'll go to Mr. Kemp, and then we'll go to our Northern County Commissioners.
Are we handing out the A1 amendment?
could treat this as an author's amendment. I'll go ahead and move that.
Senator Chaudhry has moved the A1 amendment. Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Mr. Kemp, why don't you come up and, while he's coming up, let me just talk about a little bit more about the process. We'll hear from a few folks now. You know, anyone who wants to talk on it will certainly get that opportunity. Tonight, I just want to make sure that our out-of-town and really out-of-town guests are able to talk, and then we'll set this aside. We will also be hearing the Bowser bill. I'm author of that as well. So we'll be able to talk a little bit more about kind of the total wetland approach. But, you know, members, we got to do some things here. We just, the status quo is not acceptable. We're losing ducks too fast. No one feels, you know, we heard from the aquaculture people, well, we're not the cause of wetland and the ducks going away. And we're going to hear from other people who say, well, we're not the cause. I think everything together here, everything we're doing is the cause. And so, bit by bit, we're going to have to start addressing all of these things. And if we don't, we're just going to be on the same track we were between 1900 and 1991. So we've got to do something.
Good evening. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
My name is William Kemp. I'm the president of Minnesota Waterfowl Association. I was not aware I was going to be up here today. But what I have to say is basically being with Minnesota Waterfowl, it's not only the loss of wetlands that's hurting us, but the wetlands we have no quality anymore. They're gone. The ducks aren't coming. They're not feeding because there's nothing there. And until we go address not only the loss of wetlands, we have to also address the wetlands deterioration to a point where it's no longer good for anything. And all the building and all that other stuff is fine, but the more water we keep pouring in with the phosphorus and everything else in it, we keep pouring into the wetlands and our lakes, it's deteriorating to a point where we're not going to have ducks at all. We're not going to have a lot of habitat. It's not just ducks. They're the birds and everything else that's involved in a wetland. The ecological system in a wetland is unbelievable. If I had known this, I might have been able to bring a something to put up to show you. The ecological system involved is unbelievable, and we've lost it. Anybody from the DNR that studies wetlands will tell you and agree with me on that one, I'm sure. But beans, I wasn't really ready to hear, but I, if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer whoever said.
Mr. Kemp, Senator Stump.
Mr. Chair, and then is it Mr. Kemp?
Yes.
In one of the previous bills, I forget which one it was, there is some discussion about Minnesota, I think someone from the DNR mentioned that Minnesota has more duck hunters than any other state. Is that a possible reason why we might not have as many ducks?
No. Actually, the population has gone down, and California has more duck hunters than Minnesota does now, to be honest truth. But irregardless, our duck hunters, our youth, there is no ducks. People are going out, and who wants to go out and sit and... And, you know, younger kids don't want to. People like me, I enjoy going out and sitting out there. This fall, I was fortunate. My son is young and strong, and I'm not, so he took 48 pellets and walked them out one by one out to a pond so I could go out and hunt. I've got some health issues, so that's the best way I could get out there. And we had some good hunting. but I've talked to probably 50 people that didn't even shoot a duck on opening day. And opening weekend is supposed to be when most of the ducks are shot, and they're not there. The hunters aren't there either. The hunter, if you check, as far as 10 years ago, the amount of duck stamps and the amount of a hunting license sold for duck hunting, I would say we probably got, and this is just out of my mind, at least a 20% reduction in hunters out there because there's nothing there. And the youth, it's just, we're losing our youth when it comes to hunting ducks and stuff because they want to go out and shoot a gun. There's nothing to shoot. I'll go out there and just watch things fly, but, you know, the hunting population, I don't think any count on it because there's just nothing there to shoot. So,
Mr. Chairman, one more duck question. Is there a shift in the flyway I haven't hunted ducks in many years, but some people I've talked to said that the shift in the flyway is out west.
That's where the water was.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's different. I mean, I wouldn't say North Dakota's got a lot of water. They've got some, but I mean, they've had drought kind of conditions.
In the last 2 years, yes. But the flyway went out there because they were flooded out there, and there was a lot of water in North and South Dakota. The flyway went there. The Missouri River's out there. The flyway. And, like I said, even the wetlands we had here would not draw ducks because there was no feed in them. The divers are no longer in existence. People don't even see them. The bluebills is almost, the population of bluebills is getting down to a point where I don't know if they're even going to allow bluebill hunting in the state anymore. I mean, that's just about how serious it's getting. There just aren't anymore. The divers are just not around. There's nothing for them to feed on. Like I said, when they come to the wetlands we have, the quality is gone. Why? There's a lot of different reasons, like he says. There's a lot of different, but they're gone.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kemp, how's the goose hunting been lately?
Goose hunting is great. So that but they have adapted to urban. All your geese, look at the geese you got around here on your golf courses and everything else. Goose is adapted, but a lot of the geese don't even migrate anymore. They stay right here. The ones in Rochester, they stay right here. Ducks still migrate. And ducks need nesting habitat, and ducks need different food. Your mallards are doing pretty good because they're a pothole duck, and they can feed on just about a little bit of anything. But they go out away from the water and feed. They feed in fields, corn and grain and stuff like that. But like I said, your divers don't. They feed in the water. There isn't. But no.
Other questions? Mr. Kemp, thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Should we go up north, Senator Chaudhry?
Yep.
Let me call Wade Pavlik, Coochaching County Commissioner, to the witness stand.
While he's coming up, I did have we have two other amendments. Did we do the A1?
We did A1.
Okay, I've got the A2 as well. This is, this I'd meant for them all to be together, but this is kind of a back off amendment. It's maybe not as much as some would like, but this is doing something to address the issue of the reason for denial issue, and I'm amending that. And then on the stormwater requirements, I'm exempting rain gardens. So that would be the amendment that I'd
offer. Senator Chaudhry has offered the A2 amendment to Senate File 1137. I'll give you just a moment here. I see Senator Ingebrigtsen doesn't have any comments. Senator Stump.
Just as as the amendment's getting handed out, if we could just have a definition of a rain garden.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, we don't define rain garden, but what we do say is that, you know, the board will define whether the rain garden is can be part of this credit. So it's a, as opposed to, at the moment, any type of rain garden would not be allowed a credit under my bill. So this this is a bit of a loosening up of my bill.
I'm just wondering what actually is a rain garden.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf. A rain garden is basically a depression that you create on the land, a lot of times on a lawn or around a commercial building, and then you direct your rain spout coming off the roof into that, and then you grow wildflowers and native species and such. And if you do it the right way and protect it, it actually could turn into a wetland somewhere down the line. But and it may not, and so that's why we're allowing the board of Bowser to consider whether it's can get that wetland replacement credit. I think that's it's a good practice that's being used more and more, and it may not exactly be a wetland, but I think it's a type of incentive that should be part of our rules.
Just to follow up on that, how would that differ than if you have a development that actually, you know, really reconstructs a larger collection system? I mean, and I'm thinking of a city like Moorhead, where they basically have gotten, it's a natural, it's built into golf courses, and it's, you know, it's really landscaped really nicely. And I think there's cattails that are growing around them and everything. But it actually is a kind of a flood control to a certain extent. I mean, they're not large, they're, you know, relatively small, but would that be a similar to a rain garden? Or?
It depends on how that flood control is constructed, I would guess. If it's constructed kind of in the form where, there's some sort of depression and there's native plants and it's kind of a natural area, then it could very well. But I'm letting Bowser decide that for the purposes of the credit.
Committee to Senator Chaudhry's A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
And then the A4, and then I will be done, and I'll let the other folks talk. This is just, I'm just kind of recodifying the citizen enforcement section, just kind of making it, and just designing it more of what I intend it to be. And that's kind of more of a citizen complaint process, but there is, the substance of it is not changing. I'm just kind of reordering it so it looks less onerous. So if the committee could just indulge me on that, I'm sure this section is going to be revisited.
To Senator Chaudhry's A4 amendment, committee, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is in shape, and we will go to Mr. Podlick from Wichita County. Thank you for your patience and welcome. Please identify yourself for the committee.
My name is Wade Pavlik. I'm a commissioner up in Coochiching County, International Falls. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
The chair members, you know, I'm going to be, I know you're tired. I am. I left Washington, D.C. at 2 this morning, and I just got wind of this, actually, when I got here to Duluth, Minnesota, so I turned around and came back because it's that important to Coochiching County where I live. First of all, I want to dispel a couple of things. I know you've heard a lot of testimony this year on this issue, And I've been down here for a little bit of it. I haven't testified. But I want to dispel some of the things you're hearing. And with all due respect to Senator Chaudhry here, I've heard this from him and other people. They sit here and tell you, we're losing wetlands. I'm telling you, there is no conclusive proof of that. There is no data. All the decisions that were made and the governor's letter that went to Bowser, it was based on LGU reports only. That's local government unit reports that they reported on wetland transactions that took place within those local units of government. They did not take into account all the other actions that have been done by, you know, environmental groups that are out there doing good work. But just like you can't believe the senator, and I don't mean that disrespectfully, you can't believe me either if I sat here and told you, hey, we're gaining wetlands. I don't know either, because there is not the conclusive proof. And the reason there's not is that the state of Minnesota does not have a comprehensive inventory of these wetlands. That is a fact. That is the truth. And until you have that, I mean, I don't know how you operate here, but I know as a commissioner, I need facts before I make decisions that are going to have huge effects on so many people. And this does have a huge effect on the people in northern Minnesota. I'm here tonight as a Coochin County Commissioner, but I'm representing Northern County. The Northern Counties Coordinating Board represents, it's a series of counties on the northern tier representing about 30% of the geographical area of Minnesota. And it's not a surprise. We have most of the wetlands, which is the reason we're concerned about it. You know, I was probably at a keg party too back then, but I did take a break and come down here and work on that legislation with Mr. Harnack and Senator Stumpf was there and a few others. Those were hard-fought negotiations. We all got a little bloody. But at the end of the day, we shook hands and we reached an agreement. Where I come from, that's a deal. We've lived by it all these years, and we see no evidence, or I've seen no conclusive evidence, nor has anyone else in Northern Counties, that we are in fact losing wetlands. We are all committed to preserving those wetlands and to making improvements. But, you know, I thought we did a roundtable here in St. Cloud this fall, and if I sound a little frustrated, it's because I am. I thought we reached some conclusions, and that's a bill that's going to be coming before you tomorrow. You're bringing it, correct? Thank you. And I think we all went home feeling, well, we've all given up something here, but at least we can live with this. Now I see a bill introduced here tonight that undoes the things that northern counties felt the strongest about. The exemptions is a good example. 10,000 square foot in Coochin County. I was in NACO this week. You know, like I told them, we got a county up here with more wetlands than anyone in the state, let alone the state. You know, wetlands is an issue for a lot of other states too, and some of the federal initiatives that are out there. But when a 10,000 foot exemption, we've got a county of, it was 18,000 people when I started as a commissioner, and I must not be a good economic developer because we're down to 14,000 now. You know, Senator Lessard was here and Representative Anderson, who helped work on these things too. It is almost impossible to do development up there. You can't walk anywhere without disrupting a wetland. So for us to not have a tool like a 10,000 foot exemption, and that's not very big, we're talking a house on a small driveway, without that kind of exemption, we're dead in the water, and we're going to continue to lose population. We have different problems up there than you have down here. We need those exemptions to continue. We can't do anything without them. You know, it was, the rest of the state too. You know, unfortunately, they're going to lose their exemptions if this were to proceed, or they're going to lose half of them. For those of you who've had a chance to read it, I only skimmed through it. It affects each area of the state differently. But what we recognize in the far north, and I can tell you this from personal experience, we did an airport project, which Congressman Oberstar, bless his heart, got us some money to do. You know, there's only a few air carrier airports in Minnesota. International Falls was lucky enough to be one of them. But to do that extension, guess what we had to contend with? Wetlands. And then we had to deal with all the agencies, including the Army Corps of Engineers, which I'm going to tell you is a nightmare. To make a long story short, what we ended up having to do was mitigate that wetland at 8,000 an acre, I believe it was. And we had to do it right next door. We didn't have, you know, here we are, the biggest wetlands in the state, and we can't find anything to mitigate. So we do it next door in another swamp over by Red Lake. The point being is, you know, it's real hard for me to tell my constituents why I'm charging them all this money to replace a swamp next door in another swamp. If nothing else comes out of this, the banking issue, and I've heard other people say this, would be a win-win. We recognize that as a problem. We would, if we're going to pay for this up in Cooch and all those northern counties, because every project we do is going to require mitigation, unlike a lot of the rest of the state, then why not put it in a bank and replace wetlands in Minnesota where they're needed to help those ducks? You know, I'm all for that. I'm a duck hunter. Geese are overrunning us. We still have a lot of ducks up there, but maybe that's because we have all our wetlands. But if it went to a bank instead of right now the priority is, you know, from Bowser and from the federal government, in kind, in place, and, you know, in the same watershed. Think about it. That doesn't make sense if you're already 90% wetlands. Let's put it in a bank and replace it in areas of the state where we can do the most good for Minnesota. I mean, there's got to be some common sense to this. So I'm going to conclude. You know, I hope I get to testify again, because, again, I wasn't prepared for this. I just got it. There's a lot of points I'd like to make. But I want to conclude by saying this. You know, when you look at this situation, and I personally think it's gone well since 1992 when we all argued this out. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be some changes, and I think the agreements we made at the roundtable with Bowser and what they're going to put forward before you, we feel we came a long way, and we're willing to support that. But if that's not going to be the deal, again, a deal's a deal to me. And I know, you know, some of my friends on the other side, and they are my friends, and I certainly understand their position too. They say, well, you know, times change, people change, deals are made to be broken. Well, that may be, but if you're going to break a deal, there should be a consensus on breaking that deal, how we do it so that it works for everybody. I can't emphasize that strongly enough, because we have to fight hard for everything we get up there. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to the committee. I certainly respect everyone's opinion, including the chairman's here, but I just want to let you know that it's a big issue to the northern counties of Minnesota, and I dare say to a lot of the other counties who worked with us originally, and I see representative from Anoka County who were front and center with us in 1992 also. So with that, I would certainly entertain any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Great testimony, Mr. Pavlik. Are there any questions? Senator Dill.
Well, I'd like to, Mr. Chairman, members, I'd like to thank Mr. Pavlik for coming down here to testify and considering the fact that you were up at 2 a.m. or got back at 2 a.m. this morning, right, from Washington?
Correct. No. I got up at 2 in Washington. I had to catch the plane at 5:30 or something.
You've had a long day anyway.
Yeah.
But somewhere along in this meeting, I would like to ask you or anybody else in this room what we meant in 1991 when we said the policy of this state will be no net loss of wetlands. And I was a co-author of the bill. I was in the House at the time, went through the conference committee, and I would like to know if anybody at that time said, well, what we mean by the no net loss is only what occurs within the regulatory program. I don't think I ever heard that until this year, when the MCEA turned out that report, which I consider a report that is very misleading, because they don't talk about all the wetlands that were restored in the state and other programs. I think what we meant, no net loss of wetlands, meant the whole range of government programs, that's a policy of the state, and we're not going to lose any more wetlands, but we meant all the programs we had, federal programs and all the things that were going on. And in my mind, we clearly are not losing wetlands if you take into account everything. Now, Mr. Harnack was there. Now, maybe he remembers better than I what happened. And Leroy Stump was there, Senator Stump. And Ron Nargang. And there's some other lobbyists around here, too. Jerry Schoenfeld was involved in that. And anyway, I'm just asking anybody in the room if they can set me straight. Did we mean only the regulatory program when we said no net loss, or was it a broad policy that would have included every government program we had out there, everything was going to happen? That was what our goal was. Now, you were there. What do you remember?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, when we shook hands on that deal, and by the way, I got to tell you, Mr. Harnack came up in his body armor, but he was brave enough to come to the Cooch-Chin County Board, and we were the last ones to go, as I recall. But when we made those agreements, that's the way it was explained to us. It was through the regulatory framework that we were going to, and we would still be able to do some of these developments. through time, you know, different. What I've learned through the years, is my years as a commissioner, is that depending on who you deal with at any agency, personalities get involved and they interpret things differently. A lot was left, I'm afraid, to interpretation. Intent is something you would have to address, but that's certainly the way we look at it. I can tell you this, there was never a mention of forestry roads. The inclusion of forestry roads, which I skimmed over in here, would literally close down Coochin County. I mean, when it says we're gonna mitigate a forestry road if it's used for any other purpose than cutting timber, my gosh, what's a state going to do? The state's got leases out there with cabins on forestry roads. We'd have to block off all of ours because there are cabins. People use them for hunting, etc. The point I'm trying to make is that was our interpretation, but over time that's gotten stretched into some of these other things. Having said that, when we sat down in this committee this fall, we all recognized the need to protect wetlands. We were willing to give some on that issue, and we made the argument that, in fact, we believe we are gaining wetlands, but again, without that comprehensive inventory, no one can say for sure. But that, my recollection is exactly yours.
Any other questions?
We should probably move to the next witness.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Not that I don't want to.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You woke me
committee.
Up.
I just want to point out to the committee that Todd Beckel from Lake of the Woods County could not come back for this evening. So we'll go to Bruce Cox, Clearwater County. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Cox. Please identify yourself for the committee.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Bruce Cox. I'm the Clearwater County Land Commissioner, and also I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Land Commissioners. We manage a little over 2.8 million acres of tax forfeited land across northern Minnesota, including Coochin County. In Coochin County. I'm just going to speak to the forestry exemption tonight, and I'll be short and do that. Last spring, when the governor sent out the request to the wetland or the Board of Soil and Water Resources, a request to review the exemptions and the state of the wetlands in Minnesota. We were involved through that process because the forestry exemption is important to us. And as we followed through, one of the things that that came out of that was the fact that the land managers in northern Minnesota, for the most part, used the Minnesota Forest Resource Council site-level guidelines when they're doing forest management in the forests of Minnesota. Those guidelines preclude us from impacting wetlands if we can. And if we can't, we generally look at opportunities to access during frozen periods. Another thing that come out of that is those, the use of the guidelines have been monitored for about the past 5 years. I don't want to get into numbers and details, but like the last 5 years. And the monitoring results have shown that the impacts to wetlands through forestry activities has been very small over that period of time, less than 40 acres. When you figure each year the amount of acres that are harvested, that's fairly inconsequential. Any impact, I agree, is not intended, but it might happen. So anyway, at that time, it was kind of agreed that the forestry exemption is fine, it's not a big problem, and it was passed on that way. And that action is reflected in the Bowser bill, in that you don't see the forestry exemption in that bill. This one put some conditions on that exemption, and the way we look at it, those conditions, it's not an exemption anymore. It puts us in the spot, it becomes permissive, and that's a cost to the land manager, it's a cost to the logger, It's a cost to the local government filing and dealing with these things. So I would just request that on our behalf you would seriously consider leaving that forestry exemption the way it is and trust us in that we have done a good job of maintaining those wetlands in the work we do through the guidelines, and let us continue to work out there without these conditions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Cox? Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for staying this evening.
Thank you.
Thank Senator you. Chaudhry, it's your call here. What would you like to do?
So we'll lay over this bill, and we'll be visiting, revisiting this